This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Try to put on the show.
The Huskies in familiar position. The Huskies with an all-too-familiar result. Washington leading by 11 with 6 minutes left in last night's game at Utah. And I don't know if I've ever seen a game end quite like that, but I've seen a second-half lead blown, not similarly, but just as devastatingly. So the University of Washington loses 67-66, and Michael Bumpus is in today for Paul Gallant. Utah scored its final 12 points on free throws. It was an inexplicable end to the game, and the Huskies have some tough questions to answer, Bump.
Yeah, that's one of the worst ways to lose. That's the second time in consecutive games they've blown a second-half lead of 10 points or more. Actually, the fourth this season where they've blown a lead of 10 points or more. And when you're sending guys to the free-throw line off a flagrant foul and then foul them at the three-point line, it just seems like a team that's out of control. And then what was frustrating for me is how does – Stewart not touched the ball that last possession. They did not get the ball down to the big man and let him go to work. It was a struggle, had to settle for a three. They just look really disorganized. But the positive is their defense was pretty tight. I mean, say what you want, towards the end of the game, they kind of let it get away from them. But throughout the game, they were flying around. They were getting hands on balls. They were playing tight defense. Just couldn't seal the deal for the second straight game. That has to be frustrating.
This team is close to being good. This team has the talent to be good. And when your team isn't good and is 2-4 in the conference, it kind of heightens those. I agree with you. I thought they played really well. Certainly the first half, I thought they played really well against Oregon. The problem, and this game was different than the Oregon loss. The Oregon's a really talented team, and they got it going at the end, and you have to give some credit to them. This was more of a Husky implosion. And there are going to be a lot of people that are going to point at the officials. And look, Utah shot 32 free throws, and Washington shot 14. I look at the mistakes that Seattle made that Washington made, and specifically Jaden McDaniels, who's a very talented freshman. He got his fourth technical foul of the season. I haven't seen a replay of what actually caused it, but it was part of the pivotal game deciding sequence in which Hamir Wright is called for a foul and fouls out. Then there's a flagrant foul or a technical foul that's called off the ball, saying that McDaniels hit an opponent in the head. So at that point, you've got four free throws going to be shot by Utah. Plus, they get possession of the ball because it was a technical foul. On the ensuing possession, then there's a three-pointer that McDaniels fouls out of the game. They attempted seven free throws in the span of 30 seconds without Washington ever touching the ball, Bump.
Yeah, it was like what Utah needed to happen to win this game happened. And that's what's frustrating, especially when you have the lead with seconds left on the clock and you pretty much beat yourself. You send them to the free throw line, seven consecutive free throws. You don't take any time off the clock. And then, like I said, the most frustrating thing for me was the last possession. It was like there wasn't a play drawn up. They're just dribbling at the top of the perimeter, trying to swing the ball around. Stewart's down low trying to make his money. Can't get him the rocks, and they're forced to shoot a low percentage shot. It was just very disorganized. The last minute, 2 minutes of that game was very disappointing. And as a coach, I can only imagine what that feels like, watching your team just implode, like kill themselves. So, yeah, they got some things to do. They don't seem like a team that's in last place. Talent-wise, they don't seem like a last-place team in the Pac-12. You look at this team, you're like, there's talent there. So it's looking tough for them to get into the tourney. I don't know if they can turn this around at this point. Last week, I was optimistic. This week, I'm not sure.
What do you do if you're a coach with Jaden McDaniels? We'll play Mike Hopkins sound. Jaden McDaniels is an extraordinarily talented player. He's inconsistent, which is not surprising. He is a true freshman. He's 19 years old. He's 6'9". He has a perimeter game. The first time that I watched him play, I was like, he is going to be up and down this season. That's just the reality of players of that size. He's not a post player like Isaiah Stewart is, who is a grown man at the age of 18. And you're right, they needed to get him the ball late. Jaden McDaniels has now had two times in Pac-12 losses where I've seen him in some ways, I don't want to say lose it because that implies he throws a tantrum. But after a couple calls go his way, he then in some ways checks out and he stops caring whether or not he fouled again. Once he got called for the technical foul saying that he hit the opponent in the head, He then fouled a guy on a three-point attempt, which you absolutely can't do. Here's what Mike Hopkins had to say in cut number one, asked about McDaniels, the foul situation, the fact he now has four technical fouls, specifically that sequence in the second half that included his technical foul.
I don't think there's anything going on. I just don't know why the hell that play is made. I don't know. I don't know if it's a game play or, you know, he's the nicest kid in the world. I don't get it.
Kind of disbelief or uncertainty what to do. What do you do as a coach when you've got a player that's really talented and for whatever reason, whether it's a lack of focus or not knowing how to handle frustration, how do you get that? Because what Jaden McDaniels, how he's handling that frustration is actually getting in the way of them winning games.
Yeah, it's like he's throwing a tantrum. You know, he's making poor decisions out there. What do you do? I think you just make the kid aware of the situation. You got to realize he's young, 17, 18 years old. He plays for the University of Washington, grew up in Washington. I'm sure he has a lot of pressure on him, all his buddies going to his games. People can access him who he grew up with easily. So he might be facing some things that we just don't know about, going to school and figuring out time management. Like, people just see the result on the basketball court, but there could be a lot of other things that are going on that are affecting his play. Not making excuses for the guy, but I've been there. I've been an athlete. I'm away from home and in college and having all these different pressures and learning how to manage your schedule. So it may be deeper than basketball. On the basketball court, you just got to make this kid aware. I mean, obviously, he's shown that in those moments, he might not make the greatest decisions. So what do? Man, you give him reminders, key words. Hey, hands up. Don't foul. We have time. You know, maybe you have to communicate with him a little bit more because he's shown that late in the game or during the game period, he might just lose his stuff.
I've long had a theory about how summer league basketball and the basketball development program, how it in some ways players who are extraordinarily talented, it doesn't prepare them as well for some of the frustrations that they're going to face. There's so many games that kids play and they're not focused on the results of those games. AAU summer league development is about skills showcase. It's the size and your shooting range and you play so many games that most guys are not fixated on the results. And I think there are times when guys then get put into a much more structured environment, which high school is to a limited extent, but college really is. They don't necessarily know how to handle frustration and getting mad. And, well, there's just another game and this ref doesn't like me this game. And checking out. The problem is that game was so winnable last night.
Yeah.
Utah's not very good. Utah and Washington had him on the ropes. They had him beat. And Washington, kind of because they got frustrated, the calls, and I think that you can go back and look at and ask, and it's fair to ask, that free throw disparity, 32-14, is that home cooking? That's what people would technically say. Maybe Utah was a ton more aggressive. Here's what I know, is that Washington didn't adjust to that reality, and they let it get in their heads, and tough teams don't do that. Tough teams, even when they're frustrated with a bad call, they don't then go commit a foul on the next possession because they're like, well, they're just going to charge me with a foul no matter what I do. Like, they kind of buckle down and stay as tough. And Washington is not a tough team. They're not tough, especially in the second half of close games.
No, they're not. You know, they're not closing it out. And you speak about their toughness. And naturally, I'm watching this game. I'm like, they look like a young team right now. But you look at their starters. There's two freshmen. Two juniors and a sophomore. So there's some experience out there, but you're leaning on freshmen to win games for you. I think that when you lean on freshmen to win games for you, if they're not, you know, in a Kentucky system or a Duke or something like that, it just looks a little different when you're leaning on these freshmen who aren't going to in those programs, you know? So it's learning curve, man. This is part of growing up. Unfortunately, when you're 18, 17 years old, you're playing on ESPN, you're growing on the basketball court. You know, you're growing within your program. People are seeing your ups and downs, your smiles and frowns, and I think that's what we're getting right now. Can McDaniels turn this thing around and turn his response to stuff around? Most definitely. But I'm with you. I'm thinking he's experienced some things that he's not used to. In basketball, in high school, he went to Federal Way High School, I believe. I'm sure the plan was give McDaniels a ball, get out the way. AAU, I'm sure the plan was give McDaniels a ball, get out the way. College basketball is so much more of a team sport than the NBA and high school, just because there's a system that you have to go through. There's a process of stuff. In the NBA, it's kind of just let your best player do your thing, roll some pick and rolls. And in the offense and a defense in college, there's just more structure to it. So I'm thinking I'm just seeing a kid who's trying to adjust, whether that be on the basketball court with the system and his coaches, learning how to deal with his frustration. You know, maybe he missed an assignment and he's at school and he's angry about that. There are so many things that affect young athletes, especially in college. So at this point, I think it might be deeper than basketball.
And we've also got a situation where for Seattle, and this city has seen this story before, where you have this incredibly talented freshman class, and they're ready, they're capable of doing all these things, and then, well, man, you get in, and it's just, they underachieve. It's happened before, it's just that it happened with Romar, and now you've got two guys who are considered one-and-done type talents, two freshmen who are really highly recruited, and they come back, and it does show the difficulty of relying on players who are incredibly talented to come in and play right away. Because, man, right now they're certainly missing some of the veteran leadership, and not having Quad A Green really affects them. It is Danny and Gallant, Michael Bumpus in for Paul Gallant today. Right now we're going to tell you what to watch for.
What to watch for every morning at 7:10. Brought to you by Dubin Law Group. The first look at the stories worth watching today with Danny and Gallant.
Mitch Haniger underwent core surgery. Yep, it's a big bummer. He missed the entire second half of last season after suffering a foul ball that he took off the groin, suffering an injury. This happened within the last 3 days or so, and he's undergoing surgery. He's not going to be available when the regular season starts. Probably more like late April that you can target seeing Mitch Haniger.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. He's had a tough year so far. He got injured last year, now has a groin issue. They're hoping he's going to be out 8 weeks, so he might miss the start of the season. But that's going to give opportunities for other guys like Jake Farley and Brandon Bishop. So you know how it is. Next guy up, the thing they're going to miss most about this guy is that with this young team, with all these young guys they're bringing in, he was the old guy. He's only about 28, 29 years old, but he's the old guy out there. He's been there. He's done that. So his presence will be missed. He'll still be around, but a setback for Haniger for sure.
What to watch for?
You interested in slow dancing? You want to watch some slow dancing? Bump.
Do I want to?
Because I've got just the thing for you. Yeah, do you want to watch guys slow dance? Watch the line play. NFL Pro Bowl Sunday at noon on ESPN. The dodgeball games last night, those were interesting. The Pro Bowl is one of the toughest watches in the sports calendar.
It is difficult
to watch that.
Yeah, the Pro Bowl. It's like they're playing patty cake at the line of scrimmage. It is what you know. What they should do? They should just put them in flags and just let them go at it that way. That's a lot more safer. Guys aren't risking their careers, I guess. But it is an honor to be selected to the Pro Bowl, so they do show up. But the main thing is get out healthy. But I will not watch that game.
Can you imagine how insufferable Gallant would be if they were actually playing flag football?
You'd want to get out there.
The level of expertise that he would provide, like you see, he's not able to, it's slippery, there's monsoon conditions, you can't pull the flags. Everybody's bad at flag pulling in these stats.
It'd be Booger McFarland.
Boog found his calling, man. Boog can do dodgeball. I don't know about Monday Night Football, but he can do dodgeball.
What to watch for?
I mentioned the Washington Huskies are now 2-4 in conference play. They play at Colorado Saturday at 6 p.m., It's a bummer. This is a team, they look a whole lot different at 4-2, and they've had double-digit leads in the second half of both these last two conference losses. Just brutal for them.
Yeah, it's brutal, and they're taking on Colorado. Colorado's ranked 23rd in the country, 4-2 in the pack, 15-4 overall. It's a solid program. Just beat up on my Cougs, 78-56, so a tough game to kind of bounce back from, but they're capable. That's the thing. There's no one in the Pac-12 to where you're like, okay, the Dogs just don't have a chance. Anyone can be anyone in the Pac-12. So let's see if they can get it together, keep their composure, have a nice bounce-back game against a quality opponent.
That is what to watch for. We now turn our attention back to the NFL, where there's some news with the courts relating to Antonio Brown. Let's check in with the professor, John Clayton, on our morning drive.
John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
It's a four-way battle, and there's only going to be three spots. Somebody has to go.
The first and final word on everything NFL from the professor, John Clayton.
Presented by Infinity of Tacoma at 5.
They scored 30 points a game. They're the best running team in football.
It's John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
Good morning, professor.
Good morning.
Did you like the dodgeball last night? Did you watch any of that?
I did not watch it, no.
some Jarvis Landry was the winner, but I have some objections about his strategy. He didn't peg anybody with the ball. All he did was catch. It sounds like Antonio Brown has turned himself into authorities. He's facing three criminal counts. I think that includes a felony assault. He's been released on bond. He's not close to getting back. Do you think we'll see him in the NFL at any point next season?
No, I don't think so. I mean, right now, I mean, you know, it's gone this long on the investigation. And of course, I mean, the things that's going on in his life right now are much worse than what I think they're even investigating. I mean, he had $100,000 that they had to post for bond. I saw that, you know, he has to get mental evaluations. He has to go through all these different tests and things like that. I mean, he's going to be under a GPS or something like that. So he can't even leave his house without anything. This is a bad situation, but I think that, you know, the only way that he gets back in the league is that if he finds a way to mentally get better, because mentally it's not there right now. And so I think this is scary. I am happy that the police now said they have to take his guns away, or at least find a way to stash them, because again, you kind of worry, could he do something really bad there? But no, this is the Antonio Brown story. One is one of the worst you can find right now, and he's got to find a way to get himself better, because right now it's just not working.
John, have you ever seen anything like this? An AB story, like any other athlete has been through something like this over your years of covering football?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, you look at this, the problems that Richie Incognito had, you know, and fortunately, I don't know what he did to get things right, but he did get things right. I mean, he was going through it. And I think that, you know, you unfortunately get to see it with some of the older players that have had CTE and things of this nature. So, yeah, I mean, it's not good. And what you worry about is, okay, what damage is he going to do to others, and what damage could he do to himself?
Yeah, that question, the 360 text in, do you think Antonio's meltdown is CTE related? He had he was hit in the Cincinnati Bengals playoff game. That was 2015, because I think it was the same year the Seahawks played the Minnesota Vikings. And I think that's a question everybody has. The other part is, though, is that sometimes it's not an injury that, and you can't excuse, there's got to be a level of personal accountability as well. Like, I hate the assumption that anything anybody does wrong isn't their fault, that there's a certain level of personal responsibility, but you see what's happening, and it seems more like a celebrity meltdown. In the ways that he keeps broadcasting things and kind of keeps being in the news. Usually when Richie Incognito, people kept finding out about the trouble that he was getting into. In Antonio Brown's case, it's almost like he's broadcasting it.
Yeah, because he'll put it on social media, and you say, what are you doing? And so that's why I don't buy the idea that a Vontaze Burfict hit is the one that put him in this situation. That's too simple to explain. There's too many complex problems going on there that one hit didn't really start this. There's something going on with his mind, with the way that you know, he acts and all that stuff that I think is more complex. And that's why, you know, and everybody tells you now, it's like it's Drew Rosenhaus, his agent, his ex-girlfriend. It's like they're all separating for him. It says until he gets himself some help, we want to stay away from him. And that's, I think, probably the wise thing to do. He needs help. And again, it's not just one simple hit that I think caused this.
John, he's 32 years old. He has all these issues. Have we seen the last of Antonio Brown in the NFL?
I think so, yeah. I just can't see anybody taking a chance. Again, I guess we probably were saying the same thing about Richie Incognito when he went berserk in that funeral home where his father was you know, having his funeral, and he was threatening people there, and some of the other incidents that he's had. And so I guess, you know, if he can get his mind right and get things going, then I think he can come back. But right now, I think you can't project it because the mind is not right.
John, other things in a piece of information that came out, reported concussions rose slightly during the NFL's 2019 preseason and regular season. I've always said one of the tough things about gauging this is we're still at the point where they're trying to get an accurate reading on the number of concussions. The fact that they went up doesn't mean that more are occurring, because I think guys are more willing now to say that, hey, I suffered something happened, like Carson Wentz in the game, to be more honest about what's going on in their heads. So while they say the report is the number of concussions are up, I think that might just be a reflection of people more accurately reporting what's happening to them, as opposed to the fact of are more guys suffering concussions.
Yeah, because again, you have more people looking from the press box, trying to study it, more officials now watching it. And so, yeah, I think there's a better system right now of trying to see if there's the potential for concussions. So, yeah, I wouldn't overdo the fact that there was an increase after a decrease the previous year. So, you know, I think you're right about that. I think that there's now more of an effort to find a way to see if there was a concussion or test to see if there's a concussion. And so, yeah, and the fact that it only went up like a small percentage, what was it, like about 4 or 5%, I think, to 224 or something like that. Yeah, I wouldn't be overly concerned. But again, you want to try to take it backwards, not forwards. And so, you know, they still got to do it. And we're still in the beginning stages of what good concussions are in the National Football League and in sports.
John, they've made rules over the past few years in the NFL to kind of help with concussions. Is there anything else you think the NFL should be doing to kind of try to help with that?
Well, I mean, I still think that the helmets, I mean, have to do it. And it's sad that the company here in Seattle is having its financial difficulties, because I think they had designed one of the better helmets that can help in this case. I think that, they need to continue to study, on the kickoffs and all that. I mean, that's one thing that Jeff Miller didn't get into yesterday, to say if there was an increase on kickoffs and kickoff returns and all that stuff. But I think that, they've got to just continue to monitor it and make sure that the hits are not going to, give you a position where you're going to have the concussion. So I think more of that has to be done. But I think there's a lot of good efforts. But I still think that equipment stuff has got to help too.
John, the Pro Bowl is one of the I forget. Do you watch it?
Barely.
Yeah, it's a tough game to watch. I don't know if there's any sort of substitute that you can make for it. I was interested to see the skills competition last night, and Russell took it pretty seriously, which was fun. There's also an interesting, we're going to talk about this coming up next, but conversation always comes up this time of year about, hey, can you have an expensive quarterback and still make the Super Bowl? And Mike Greenberg cited that since ESPN started studying quarterback salaries like 20 years ago, that a team has not gotten to the Super Bowl while having a quarterback who ranks in the top five in salary cap hits. I don't think that's necessarily an accurate representation, because we've seen a lot of franchise quarterbacks make it. But what's your opinion on that? Can quarterbacks make too much and make it hard on their team to win?
No, I mean, again, you got to try to keep it around 15% of the cap as far as the cap number, and you can do that. You can still get in. And I think those numbers are all skewed, because what you're looking at is that Tom Brady, who's taken discount type of deals, has been to 9 of them. And he's won 6 of them. And so when you're talking about, okay, winning a Super Bowl and that, I mean, well, Tom Brady's the one who's won more than anybody else. I mean, Ben Roethlisberger has always had a pretty high cap number and a pretty high salary, and he's been able to win one. And so, no, I think that those numbers are skewed, because what you're looking at in those 20 years, 20 years is basically Tom Brady. And so he's the one who takes and skews those numbers. I mean, you have to try to see if you can do it. But, I mean, here this year, I mean, you've got, Jimmy Garoppolo. We did a $27.5 million contract, and you have a quarterback who's in his still in his rookie contract. But no, I think it's still the quarterback is a quarterback driven league, and they're the most important. But I can't see, if you manage your cap right, you shouldn't have that difficulty.
Speaking of Tom Brady, what is it going to take for the Patriots to keep him in New England? What's the number?
I'd say 30, 32, somewhere in that neighborhood. I think they may be willing to go 25. And that's why you kind of wonder, it's like, for $5 million, when he's saved you so much through the years and done so much, you're really going to hold him back? That's why, you get the idea that there's a certain number that the Patriots are going to go. And, at this stage, Tom's looking at it, it's like, well, wait a second. You're saving all this money, and you give me what at wide receiver this past year? You give me what at tight end, replacing Rob Gronkowski? And so there's a distance between the two, but I think they've got to probably go to 30 to 31 million to be able to make him happy.
Professor, should we just go ahead and write Joe Burrow's name in, number one overall, going to Cincinnati?
I think so, yeah. Even again, the only thing that would change that, I think, is if his father and him make a decision that he doesn't want to go to Cincinnati. Now, his father has come out publicly and said he has no problem with that after stories started to leak out that he does have an issue. But, no, I think you just pencil his name in.
Well, that's interesting. You could pull an Eli Manning. That's the one thing to keep an eye out. John, we're grateful every time you join us, and we look forward to catching up with you next week on our morning drive.
All right, sounds good.
That is the Professor John Clayton. Can you have a top five quarterback in terms of salary and win the Super Bowl? History says no, and that's caused some questions. We'll dig into that next.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
We're about to do something that you don't do in any other industry. Nobody watches a movie and says, oh, maybe that movie would have been better if Tom Cruise would have made a little less money and they would have had more room for effects. And nobody looks at a company like Amazon and says, well, maybe Amazon would be more successful if Jeff Bezos took home a little less. Yet in football, and there's a reason for this, in football, you look at the teams who advance through the playoffs and you wonder and ask, as people are right now, would the team be a little better off if the quarterback didn't make quite so darn much money, Bump?
Yeah, you got to ask that question. People see that big number, the $100 million going on right there, and they say, well, maybe if he had a better defense. Maybe if he had a better running back. Maybe if he had a better receiver. So, I mean, you can ask those questions, and they're legit because you look at the list, guys who are getting paid aren't winning ball games.
Yeah, it's true. Here was Mike Greenberg on the show Get Up, laid it out statistically. This isn't an opinion. Here's his facts surveying the situation.
No team has won a Super Bowl when their quarterback ranks in the top five in the NFL in cap hit. That's just the reality of the situation. But this is a hard cap sport without an exemption, which I think there should be for quarterbacks or franchise players. But there isn't one because the owners don't want to give away more money, to your point. And I'm merely saying that at some point, in the way the system is set up, you are robbing Peter to pay Paul with every contract you sign.
He's right. It is really hard for me to cross to the point where I say that, well, a quarterback should take less than he can leverage out of his owner. That a quarterback should take less because the way they've set up the economic system, which doesn't look like it's going to change anytime soon, is that, well, if your quarterback maxes out, if Dak Prescott gets $37 million a year from the Dallas Cowboys, he can get it. He has the leverage. Maybe that might end up cutting short the team's success in the long term. Can you help me bridge this gap, Bump?
One, I will never, ever ask any athlete to take a pay cut. The fact that Tom Brady did it, good for him. It worked out. In the NFL, not for long. You're going to get injured. It's going to happen. Something's going to happen in your career. You get all the money you can while you can and hope that there's enough left over for the organization to build a team around you. Now, you can be a good teammate, a good person, and take that pay cut and allow the team to build, but no, Danny, I will never ask anybody to take less than what they feel they are worth.
There's part of me that thinks that this is just a beautifully set up system by the owners, where they've managed to somehow twist us around as fans, where we cheer for decisions that actually help the owner's bottom line. Like, it's sick. Like, because in a normal office profession, I think almost everybody looks at it and says, I hope everybody gets as much as they possibly can because, well, rising tide lifts all boats. And we know that the bosses make more than anybody else. And who cares about the bosses? I don't care how much money they make. Yet in the NFL, we tend to, in some ways, advocate decisions that benefit the billionaires instead of the millionaires. It's something that I've observed for a long time, and I understand it because the fan looks at it and says, hey, there's a limited pot. There's a limited pot of money to go around. And if you take more of it, if you take as much as possible, it leaves less for the other guys. And, well, the owner, he can't pay you anymore. So this is what you got to make do with. I tend to come down on your side with that question. Here would be one idea I had. What if you said, okay, I'll cede a little bit of I won't ask for the top dollar. I'll take 95% of what I think I could get, but I get to say where the other 5% goes. Because that would be like my problem. That would be my problem if I was a player, and this is stretching the bounds of all reality. But if you don't take as much as possible, wouldn't you be resentful of every little thing that they did that didn't work out? You're like, you gave $7 million to Luke Jokel. Like, I didn't get 100%, so you could pay $7 million to Luke Jokel?
Yeah, because if that's the scenario, they're using your money. They're using your money to do as they please with it.
I know.
So, no, heck no. If you're going to take a pay cut, you should have some input. I would like to think Tom Brady has some kind of input of what goes on. Football's a little different, man. There's 11 spots, 22 guys on the field at one time. Now, in basketball, a guy like LeBron has influence on where that money's going. You know, superstars in the NBA, because one player has so much influence over a game, I think those guys have a little more influence. Whereas it's here, the fans are what kind of mess it up, because the fans are so emotionally connected to the team. They want the team to succeed. They don't think about your well-being, your future, setting up your kids' kids and your grandkids and all that stuff. They just want you to do what's best for the team and not what's best for you and your well-being, which I get, because they're the ones showing up every Sunday. They're buying the jerseys. They're supporting you. So they feel some type of ownership. You know, they feel like they're a part of this, and I get it. But people got to take the jersey off and just look at the man and say, if this man is the best at what he does, why shouldn't he be compensated accordingly?
It's really interesting that you bring up the NBA, because that's exactly where this conversation goes to next. And that idea of, is salary the ultimate goal for a player? And how do you factor in the desire to win? Here's the Mike Greenberg talks about sort of objecting to the system, but understanding or seeing alternatives to how players could look at it.
I disagree with the system,
right,
where the guy has to take less money. But the basketball players do it.
Yeah.
LeBron James and Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh took less money.
Tom Brady's done it in football.
And he won six Super Bowls doing it.
But tell me other players in football who have done that. What other quarterbacks have done that?
They haven't. It's pretty much been Brady. But that's also weird, because then you're essentially citing the exception that proves how it can work. Here's my thought. This is going to be one of my sociology theories. In the NBA, there's a salary scale. You're capped. So the idea of who earns the most money, there isn't that much of a distinguished honor that goes with it. Because you get to a certain level and you're a max player, and okay, you get as much as the max is allowed. So it's almost like you get to this certain level as a superstar, everybody's the same. And in some ways, I think that's taken ego out of some of the decisions players have made, where they've been like, okay, I'll take less so I can get another guy that's that good to come in there. Why are basketball players more willing to leave salary on the table? Is it because of the volume of money they're making? Is it because of the ego of the salary? Why do you think basketball players have been a little bit more willing to do that bump?
It's the volume, and it's guaranteed money.
That's true.
It's guaranteed. NFL, that thing ain't guaranteed. You get cut, they will cut you, get a nice little settlement, move on. NBA, they're getting that paper no matter what. So it changes the way you think of things, for sure.
It's certainly, that's one of the many I always told people. I was like, which is the best sport to cover? I was like, well, basketball's pretty good because those guys aren't worried about getting fired. Like, football players have some fantastic observations about the business, about society in general, but they're a little more reluctant to share those and put their names to them because they can get fired. Basketball players don't get fired. The coaches get fired.
Exactly.
Like, basketball players can end up saying what they want. Marco Gonzalez, who spoke with Bob, Dave, and Moore yesterday, he's mad not just because signs were stolen electronically. He's upset at the way it was done. We'll explain next on Danny and Gallant.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios
on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Mariners had their pre-spring training, so their pre-training luncheon yesterday, kind of setting some expectations, and it sounds an awful lot like this year is going to be measured in development, not in wins and losses. You can hope that they'll be better the second half of the season than they are the first half, but that this is a year where we might maybe even see some growing pains as some of their younger players come through. But it was also the first opportunity for some players to talk about the sign-stealing scandal that's been in their game. And Bomb, I'm trying to think of your perspective on it. I've thought this is not surprising because we've heard it happen. It's worse than steroids in the way, in the actual effect of the cheating. I don't know how widespread it was. It sounds like a lot of teams were doing it. I also think that it was pretty low down dirty.
Yeah, I think it was dirty. Every team cheats. You look at the history of baseball, every team still signs as part of the game. Even in football, I was a high school football head coach for 10 years. If you didn't change your signs, the guy on the other sideline was going to figure it out after you played them two or three times. So Yeah, I don't agree with it. It happens in baseball. It's just the extent of this. If there really was a buzzer on Altuve's shoulder, if they really were using cameras, well, there's evidence they were using cameras. They're banging on the trash can. So there's a lot of layers to this. It's happened in the MLB for as long as they've been playing. So I get it, but the extent of this is what kind of rubs me the wrong way.
Marco Gonzalez, who is someone several years ago singled out specifically in Boston, saying that he believed something changed over the course of that game, and all of a sudden pitches that guys weren't hitting early in the game, they were hitting later, and it was because they knew what was coming. He didn't single out the Astros specifically. It was after a game against the Red Sox. He joined Bob, Dave, and Moore yesterday, and he kind of undersold how much he was going to say, because he said he wasn't going to say much, and I think he made his feelings about it pretty clear, starting with the fact that this wasn't necessarily a surprise to anyone.
Truthfully, it hasn't been a secret in the game of that this has been going on for a while. It's just taken some time to come out, the right person speaking up. But yeah, I can remember that day in that game, and obviously the emotions coming back. And like I said earlier, I'm a guy that I rely on, you know, that chess match, that off balance, the making pitches, the off speed pitches, the changing speeds. That's what I got. And that's what I've been working on for however long I've been throwing a ball. And so when I feel that that's taken away from me because they know what's coming, that's my entire game. I don't have 98. I can't blow it by you if I want. So if you know what's coming, I have nothing to work with. So that's, if I have frustration, that's because that I've been working my entire life, and I don't want that to be taken away from me.
Most guys won't be that honest about their feelings about that. You hear him talk, and you hear the direct impact that those actions had on somebody who was trying to play fair and felt like the system kind of got turned around against him.
I love it. I mean, he's honest. Like, look, this is what I do. I don't throw a 98 heater coming at you. You know, his game is to keep you guessing. And that's, to me, hitting a baseball is one of the toughest things to do in sports. You don't know if it's going to be a fastball, off-speed pitch, where it's dipping, where it's going. I mean, you have point something seconds to make a decision on what that ball is doing and try to swing away at it. And when you can get a head start, when you can get some type of cheat code to that, it definitely changes things. You can sit back on things. You can get in front of things. So I like hearing it from a guy who it directly affects. It's not the guy who's just going to blow it by you no matter what. It's a guy who has to throw that junk at you for him to be successful. Him keeping guys off balance is what got him to the majors. And you take away that from him, then who is he now? He's just an average guy. You know, so I hear the frustration, and I appreciate his honesty when it comes to this.
Would you feel at all similarly if you had found out after a season that you played that, hey, this guy that covered you in a game, this guy who had an effective and a good game and got praised for it afterwards, he was on steroids. He was on a ton of different PEDs, and it wasn't fair. Would you feel that same sort of way of like, well, somebody just got one over on me, that's just not fair?
In football, I don't know. PEDs, I would feel like I'm being cheated, but I would also think that I could find a way to be successful, because it's PEDs just make them bigger, stronger, faster. Mm-hmm. It's not telling him what I'm doing, what play that I'm running. So I don't care if you're bigger, stronger, faster. Growing up, most people I played football with were bigger, stronger, faster than me anyway. So I had to find different ways to be successful. So PEDs are different. Now, if this guy like had our playbook and was in our playbook and knew exactly what we were doing and was jumping over all of my routes, then I would feel a little differently about it. Even then, I would still feel like I could win because there's so many moving parts on a football field, to whereas on a mound, it's you and the pitcher. It's a one-on-one battle, right? Even if I have a guy on defense, if I'm playing offense in football, if he knows what I'm doing, I can still do things to get open and get other people open. So it's a little different when it comes to football and baseball. But either way, it ain't right. Cheating is cheating. If you use PEDs, you should be punished. If you are stealing signs in a way that hasn't been done for hundreds of years through baseball, naturally, organically, then you should be punished as well.
It's interesting to listen to you talk, because I think what I hear coming through is there's a difference between you building yourself up and you having an opponent having information about what you plan to do. There's a difference in someone who, even if they take drugs that aren't allowed, to build themselves up But once they get to the point where they actually, through some underhanded way, have an insight into what you're doing, that's more like actually reaching into your pocket. Like that you now have information about what my preparation is that you shouldn't have. And that's not fair. Not to say that the person who cheats and uses steroids isn't cheating, but there's a different level of cheating when you've through some underhanded manner know what your opponent is going to do. And maybe that's why, and Marco was asked in the next cut we have about what he was most mad about, what made him most angry about the reality that some other teams were stealing signs.
I'm mad at the way that they've acted throughout the time and the attitudes that they've had towards the game. Thinking you're above the game and thinking that it's okay that you're taking advantage of other guys, that's not cool. So that's all I'm mad about. I'm also mad for other players who have gone in unprepared, who don't know that this is going on. We've known for a long time that this has been going on in our game. It's a problem. And so we've tried to prepare ourselves and protect ourselves as best we can. But I'm mad for a lot of other people, too.
It's really interesting to think about what it means that sort of somebody broke the common agreement you have to compete, because everybody's trying to get that edge. But when that line is crossed, it seems very clear in some people's minds of like, okay, what you just did, that's a whole different level of trying. And now I kind of don't respect you as much as I did before.
I wonder how many guys have lost their jobs over this. How many pitchers just couldn't get it done that night and got bumped down to the minors again? You know, how many guys won their last go around trying to make it to the league, to the big show, made it there and just couldn't get their stuff right because guys were cheating? Like, you're affecting guys' livelihoods, you know, their dreams, their aspirations. So yeah, it cuts a little deep, and hearing it from a player makes me makes me look at it differently, makes me not like the situation even more, because they made it human. You know, I can watch it on ESPN. They say, oh, they've been cheating, they've been doing this and doing that. I'm like, oh man, that sucks. You know, they shouldn't be doing that. But when you hear a player, you hear the frustration in his voice, like, come on, man, there are guys out here trying to do this the right way, and the guys who aren't doing it the right way are benefiting the most, which just isn't fair.
It is Danny and Gallant. Michael Bumpus is in with us today. Our NFL playoff coverage is brought to you by Washington Farm Bureau Healthcare. Coming up next, we're going to go back to the Pro Bowl. No, it's not going to be not dodgeball yet, but I promise we'll get to dodgeball. But we're going to talk to a guy who is front row seat for some of Russell Wilson's accuracy challenges. That's coming up next. Jake Heap steps in for Blue 42.